content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the December 15, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine. The Ancient Roots of Doing Time. The historical and archaeological record upends the widespread belief that long-term incarceration belongs to the modern state, by Adam Gopnik. In Ryan George's wonderful Pitch Meeting series on YouTube, the excitable producer character, relishing the eager screenwriter character's ability to load a conflict with life or death consequences, always enunciates stakes with shivering excitement. Similarly, when we read non-narrative scholarly books, what we want in exchange for all the minutiae is a sense that something significant, something we might call stakesy, is on the line. When scholars debate the dating of the Gospels, the time difference may seem small, but the stakes are obvious. Were these texts written by contemporaries of Jesus or not? Another book, say on 18th century musket design, may take many pages before it reveals that nothing less than the proper interpretation of the Second Amendment is in play. Matthew D.C. Larson and Mark Letany's Ancient Mediterranean Incarceration is a dense, sometimes exhaustingly detailed work, but its stakes turn out to be as high as can be. The origins and meaning of incarceration itself. The central question is whether incarceration is a special affliction of the post-Enlightenment world. As Michel Foucault argued in his epoch-marking 1977 book, Discipline and Punish, a position that by the late 20th century had become, well, almost gospel. What if the history of incarceration is, in fact, remarkably continuous across time, place, and circumstance? Foucault's enveloping project was to recast Western history as a series of closed epistemes, or governing structures of thought, each redefining conventional terms like reason and humanity according to the brute dictates of power. If the central plank of this hugely influential model is rotten, then the whole might be shakier than it looks. Much of today's prison reform and abolitionist literature rest on the Foucaultian view of incarceration as a distinctly modern cruelty. Foucault's thesis, advanced as much by oracular assertion as by sustained scholarly argument, was that before modernity, punishment was almost always physical and absolute. Those designated as criminals, he contended, were torn apart, hanged, or thrown to wild beasts, but rarely locked away alone for decades in institutions designed for the purpose. Temporary confinement in a dungeon might precede crucifixion or a trip to the lions, but the notion of serving a fixed sentence in a cell was, to Foucault, a historically recent development. Instead, punishment was more likely to take the form of fines or of exile, the fate that befell the poet Ovid. For Foucault, the defining image of pre-modern punishment was the almost unimaginably brutal execution of the would-be royal assassin Robert-François Demier in the Paris of Fontenelle and Voltaire. Despite having done little actual harm to Louis XV, Damien was tortured to death before a crowd, his hands and feet burned, his flesh torn apart by horses. Such punishments, Foucault argued, were aimed at the body, to banish it or to destroy it. The Enlightenment, by contrast, privileged the mind, so the point of punishment shifted to reform, to the improvement of a misset mind by locking its owner away for years, presumably to give him time to educate it. Foucault, for his part, did not necessarily see the shift from spectacular violence to confinement as an advance in decency or compassion. To be locked away for decades was not, in his eyes, more humane than being torn apart in a public square, though Damien himself might have had a different opinion. Only when the mind, rather than the body or the soul, was seen as the true locus of danger did confinement become the preferred solution. In Foucault's account, the prison cell is not a monument to humanity, but a cage for errant consciousness. Against the idea that modern incarceration is a wholly novel phenomenon, the evidence from antiquity proves to be both abundant and conclusive. Throughout the Mediterranean world, during the Hellenistic, Roman, and Byzantine eras, there were prisons, not just temporary holding cells for the condemned en route to execution, but purpose-built structures designed to house people for extended periods. As Larson and Lettinet note, it is curious that anyone ever doubted this, given that Vitruvius, the great Roman architectural theorist, explicitly listed a prison alongside a treasury and a meeting house as standard features of a proper city center or forum. An ancient prison, the Tullian, still sits in the heart of Rome, preserved in part because a Christian church was built atop it to honor the tradition that Peter and Paul were held there before their executions. The Tullian, a dark, wet, cold underground chamber, was used for so many centuries that it was twice renovated and became a model for other prisons throughout the empire. At least four civic prisons, distinct from those attached to military camps or slave labor mines, have been identified, all following a similar architectural plan. Hard labor and prison farms were as much a feature of the ancient world as they are of our own. In recent decades, archaeologists have uncovered a major Roman prison complex at Simitus in present-day Tunisia. A facility capable of holding more than 1,000 prisoners in conditions that were, for the time, reasonably sanitary. Built beside a marble mine, it housed slaves and prisoners sentenced to short and long terms as laborers. Larson and Lettinet draw a direct comparison between Simitus and the notorious Eastern State Penitentiary built in 19th century Pennsylvania, one of Foucault's emblematic Enlightenment prisons. Simitus, too, was designed for surveillance, discipline, and punishment, a place where the metaphysical machinery of incarceration was already in operation. Tales of ancient incarceration, which might once have seemed the stuff of legend, turn out again and again to have an archaeological foundation. Plutarch, the first century Greek historian, described the misery of a prisoner in the Greek town of Messene. Modern excavations have confirmed his account down to the details. A story by the Greco-Roman satirist Lucian, meanwhile, assumes the existence of established protocols for seeing prisoners, including fixed visiting hours, assumptions that make sense only if such routines were part of civic life. The rules of Roman sentencing may have been imprecise, but life sentences certainly existed, and the prisons were genuinely residential, not merely meant for holding people before execution. People knew about incarceration. Seneca, the Roman philosopher and dramatist and court counselor, argued that punishment should be proportionate to the crime and resisted the notion that every offense required execution. Some crimes, he claimed, called for little more than a private rebuke followed by public disgrace. Others warranted exile, chains, and imprisonment. In an inscription from the 3rd century CE, a prisoner named Theodorus thanks the gods after having served a term of 22 months in a civic prison, proof that doing time was not an invention of the modern era. Graduated, reform-minded incarceration, Larson and Lettinet insist, was present more than a millennium before the Foucauldian model says it was born. Indeed, some of the most enduring myths of antiquity, often retold, even more often depicted, make sense only against the backdrop of long-term imprisonment. The tale of Perrault and Simon, for instance, is as potent as it is oddly Freudian. Perrault, a young woman, visits her starving father, Simon, in a prison and sustains him with her own breast milk. The scene appears in Roman frescoes, including a surviving example in Pompeii, and after the Renaissance, it became a staple of Western art. Rubens, naturally, offered his own disturbingly fleshy version. The story continued to be cited and pictured as an exemplar of Roman charity, but the fable couldn't have taken root if the idea of Simon's long sentence hadn't resonated with an ancient audience. The famous gospel episode featuring Barabbas, the prisoner whom Pilate offers to exchange for Jesus, depends on the plausibility, for a second century audience, of prolonged imprisonment with the possibility of parole. Ancient prisons, of course, had their own distinctive character. Most were underground, like the Tullian in Rome, buried chambers with little light or air, and only the most rudimentary latrines. One imagines a Foucauldian history of sewage and sanitation, which might prove more pivotal in the shaping of civilization than law or punishment. Certainly, the stench of antique prisons is the dominant note in the ancient reporting. And, although the microbial mechanisms of disease were unknown, it was obvious that these circumstances were insalubrious in the extreme. A set sentence could easily become a death sentence. Even that condition, though, is familiar from the debtors' prisons in Dickens, depicted in the midst of Victorian prosperity. The atmosphere of ancient prisons recalls the ones in Little Dorrit and the Pickwick Papers, situated in the middle of the city, with a relatively transparent membrane between the streets and the cells, allowing affluent letter writers and provisioners easy access to those inside. There was a kind of constant civic bargaining between guards and prisoners, depending on social status or, more to the point, the money that one had for bribes and favors. In the end, Larson and Letteny make their polemical point unambiguously plain. The modern prison, they write, is not a new construction, but an old and haunted house. For all the differences between ancient and modern practice, they conclude, some aspects of incarceration have appeared in every Mediterranean society for which we have historical data. Turning decisively against Foucault, they write that incarceration may be a facet of every hierarchical complex society. In other words, it's always been with us. What's at stake in this study is more than the truth or falsity of Foucault's account of modern incarceration. It is our picture of history itself, and of how incommensurable one period truly is with another. Under the influence of Foucault and his contemporaries, many scholars treat the so-called dialogue of the dead, the imagined passage back and forth between eras, as a kind of pious fiction. Where the third Annales school spoke of mentalités, a shared cast of mind or sensibility, Foucault proposed a more radical concept, the episteme, a matter not of shared psychology, but of the governing rules and structures that determine what can be thought or said at any given moment. We are as closed off from the ancients' mindset as firmly as they are from ours. Their assumptions and tacit expectations about the order of things are lost to us. It seems possible that prisons existed almost as an afterthought to Roman theories of law. In Andrew M. Rigsby's Crime and Community in Ciceronian Rome, for instance, we are given detailed studies of some of Cicero's surviving legal arguments in defense of Romans accused usually of high crimes, like extortion and conspiracy. There seems enormous and striking contemporaneity in the kind of reasoning Cicero uses, sometimes appealing to the letter of the law, sometimes to a larger framework of social good. So that an accused who can be shown to have done much good in the past ought to be acquitted of a presented misdeed. But there are few references to what will happen to the accused after they are convicted or acquitted. The supple flexibility of Cicero's argument is immensely impressive, and so is the sense that the jury, albeit a selective one of high-ranking Romans, will really listen to the arguments as arguments, and that the still animating Republican idea of the rule of law rather than the diktat of the emperor genuinely matters to the outcome. But the aftermath is blurred. Capital crimes entail execution or exile, presumably, but the notion of state retribution seems absent from the discourse of individual defense. Cicero himself, of course, eventually ended up executed, headless and handless, a victim of the new imperial ideal of justice. For all the resemblances between the ancient incarceration system and our own, the differences are real. Though we still see the same disparity between the noble public architecture of courts and the degraded architecture of prisons, there was nothing in antiquity close to our bureaucratic machinery for portioning out time behind bars, with its elaborate accessories, parole boards, probation hearings, sentencing guidelines. Foucault's point was, in retrospect, more illustrative than strictly argumentative. The modern prison was a black mass parody of other institutions of modernity, the factory, the office, the psychiatric hospital, where people are processed and sent on their way, reduced to abstract entries in a ledger. That some partial precedent for this practice might be found, if one looks hard enough, doesn't invalidate the general truth of the view, any more than the existence of medieval European inns offering food for money disproves the fact that the modern restaurant is specifically an invention of post-revolutionary France. Nothing under the sun is ever wholly new, but not everything is as old as time, either. And yet, the odd effect of Larson and Letney's study is to make the continuities more vivid to us than the breaks. The empathetic likeness is greater than the epistemic difference. The sum effect of their book is not so much argumentative as it is piteous. We are left with an image of countless forgotten souls, locked away in dark underground chambers. Some condemned to wait for years without hope of release, others all too aware that they might one day be thrown to the lions or leopards. Roman mosaics still survive that show leopards leaping at prisoners' faces, scenes at once horrifying and, by the strange logic of history, the remote source of a contemporary political meme. Some prisoners were doubtless guilty of some offense. Others were simply unlucky in birth or circumstance. What persists is a quiet, bitter awareness of lives long ago consigned to suffering and despair. The feeling, inescapably, is not so different from what we experience today, seeing the images from El Salvador's Cicot mega prison, rows of men, heads shaved, stripped of identity, packed into cells in a choreography of human pain, which has scarcely changed across the millennia. Suffering and cruelty, after all, are constants, remarkably consistent in their distribution throughout time. It is a familiar mistake to read Foucault through a Marxist lens, as if mass incarceration could be explained by capitalism. Doing so misses his deeper Nietzschean point. If it isn't capitalism, it will be something else. For Foucault, cruelty is the substrate of reality, the sediment that lies beneath every system we devise. Even against that darker kind of universalism, however, some light manages to break through. What lingers with us after reading this book is not so much the sense of an abstract argument won or lost as a helpless awareness of the endless, needless suffering of humanity. Although the ancient world had little resembling a modern prison reform movement, it was not without moments of indignation which still have the power to move us. Christians, perhaps, because they often came from the lower strata most at risk, formed support societies for the imprisoned. Among educated pagans, there were regular, if often ineffectual, appeals to humanitas in the treatment of the oppressed. Humanitas, as Latinists remind us, is a complex and now contested word. It refers both to a chosen curriculum and to an imperative toward compassion, to artistic cultivation, as well as to altruism. Seneca's and Cicero's invocations of humanitas were as double-edged as our own talk of the humanities, pointing at once to a body of knowledge and to a moral choice that learning might inspire. The practice of cruelty was all too real, yet so was the idea that humanity entailed a genuine feeling for the helpless. It's what Seneca meant when he wrote that we give not to man, but to humanity, not just for the people we know, but out of a shared feeling for humanity itself. If we accept a vision of history as a sequence of sealed epistemes, each age defined by its own system of cruelties, each as senseless as the last, with humanism reduced to a polite fiction, then the past loses its moral urgency. The history of imprisonment becomes a catalog of absurdities, to be met with dulled resignation. Even our efforts at reform begin to feel like the latest round in an unwinnable, ageless struggle with power. It need not be so. The dialogues of the dead are not dialogues of the deaf. The conversation between antiquity and modernity, this new study implicitly argues, is real and constructive. We feel for the victims of both times. For that matter, it's why poor, exiled Ovid and cautious, persecuted Shakespeare speak so happily across more than 1,000 years. Why Shakespeare's poems so closely mirror the Roman poets. They are speaking the same language, about the same desires and the same sufferings of the body and the heart. The idea of a common humanity, in this very stakesy view, is not an invention that separates us from the ancients, but an inheritance that connects us to them. It's what makes the dialogue of the dead a conversation among the living. And now, from the December 15, 2025 issue, how to leave the USA. In the wake of President Trump's re-election, the number of aggrieved Americans seeking a new life abroad appears to be rising. The Netherlands offers one way out, by Atossa Araxia Abrahamian. On an overcast Saturday in September, a group of travelers gathered for dinner at Jappenkirk, a brewery inside a converted church in the Dutch city of Haarlem. They had come from Texas, Iowa, and Pennsylvania, and they planned to spend the next week visiting the Netherlands. The purpose of their trip was neither business nor pleasure. These Americans were there because they wanted out of the USA. Debbie and Bain, a couple from Denton, Texas, sat at a long table on the mezzanine level, admiring the space's stained glass windows. Debbie is a 42-year-old project manager with an easy laugh and dark bangs that frame her heart-shaped face. "To be honest, it hasn't hit me yet that we're here," she said. Bain, 37, works as a freelance photographer and manages social media for an orthopedic surgeon. He enjoys heavy metal and complex tabletop games like Dungeons and Dragons and lets his wife do most of the talking. Debbie assured me that he'd been just giddy at their hotel. "This is a guy who barely shows emotions," she said. I had been in touch with Debbie and Bain throughout the summer as they planned their trip. "They'd always thought about retiring overseas," Debbie said. "But they moved up their timeline last spring because of Donald Trump's flagrant disregard of court orders. Precursors," Bain noted, "of full-blown authoritarianism." "After he took office for the second time, things got real," Debbie said. "At first, we were hopeful things would get better or not worse." "But they didn't," Bain deadpanned. The evening had been organized by GTFO Tours, a relocation service that helps aggrieved U.S. citizens start new lives abroad. The dinner was the first stop on a crash course in the Dutch way of life. The tour, Debbie and Bain hoped, would help them plan a permanent move in January. Over beers and bitterballen, breaded balls of beef stew, the conversation at the table quickly turned to politics. GTFO's clients are liberal. They all want to escape Trump. But Bain is a democratic socialist, and Debbie considers herself more of a centrist. Debbie, who has two adult sons, grew up in a military family and enlisted when she was 19. She served as a communications specialist on bases in the U.S., Korea, Iraq, and Germany, and worked as a civilian contractor in Afghanistan. Although she now feels duped by the government's rationale for the war on terror, the military allowed her to pay for school and provide for her family. She enjoyed the work. "Even in Iraq, I had a great time," she said, recalling the camaraderie. Until Debbie moved to Denton and met Bain at a bar in 2012, she had voted Republican by default. "I remember being in Iraq when Obama got elected. I didn't even know who he was," she said. She gives Bain credit for her change of heart, but also says that watching people in her community struggle made her appreciate the importance of the social safety net. "We were well taken care of in the military. You don't realize how socialistic that is. We're giving free health care, free housing, free food," she said. Coming out of isolation after the pandemic, Debbie had a harder time countenancing the inequality around her. "I felt like it was for some reason on my shoulders to fix everything," she recalled. She coped by volunteering in her community, but that did little to calm her fears. The more news stories she read about Trump's second term, the more she foresaw a time when ordinary Americans would be stripped of their civil rights and live under martial law. That didn't look like much of a future. Inflation had also made it hard to save money, and the couple's economic prospects seemed uncertain. Even though she was making six figures working for a large bank, things felt tight. Debbie and Bain worried about retirement. They sold blood plasma to pad their bank accounts. The American dream is something you're told about to make you part of a system that clearly doesn't work anymore, Bain said during one of our conversations. "I want to be where the government cares about you and takes care of you and is you." Every 4 years, a group of Americans threatens to leave the country. These proclamations tend to take place in early November and involve Canada. No mass exodus occurs. Moving is hard. Moving countries is harder. There are families, jobs, pets in the mix. This time around, though, Americans seem to be acting on their desires. The State Department does not keep close track of how many Americans settle abroad, but immigration lawyers told me that the number of people approaching them about it has gone up since Trump was reelected. Anecdotally, there's a noticeable increase, Sanja Sethi, an American attorney who recently relocated to Geneva, told me. "What's been so surprising is how much I'm hearing in my personal life, the desire to leave or get another passport." Migration is never simple, but money helps. At least half the world's nations offer visas or fast-track citizenship to foreigners in exchange for investments or cash. According to Eric Major, whose company Latitude helps people apply for such programs, citizenship by investment clients once primarily came from places with limited civil and economic freedoms, Russia, China, Iran. Now the majority of them come from the U.S. "We are seeing an increase in Americans actioning a Plan A, full outright migration, with a view of leaving the U.S., as opposed to just securing a Plan B," Major told me in an email. "We just signed up a NASA lady moving to Portugal, a SpaceX guy moving to Malta, and a Cornell University moving to London." For Americans without much money, grandparents can be a golden ticket. Tens of thousands of U.S. citizens have sought out second passports since last fall, hunting down birth registrations, marriage certificates, and records from synagogues and churches. By one estimate, 40% of Americans could be eligible for another citizenship. Failing that, online influencers advertise alternative paths to a beautiful, affordable, gun and car-free lifestyle, using Social Security payments to qualify for a Portuguese passive income visa, skirting Thai laws with regular visa runs to Cambodia, or exploiting Albania's generosity, 12 months visa-free, to try out the Mediterranean. This ever-proliferating content often glosses over bureaucracy, crime, and the fact that Westerners tend to sequester themselves in spaces that locals can't afford. Anywhere must be cheaper and less stressful than America is today. A recent study by the Harris Poll, a research firm, found that nearly half of its respondents had considered leaving the U.S., citing politics and the cost of living as their main factors. There's a historical irony to these responses. Americans are looking to emigrate for the same reasons that immigrants once came to America, for safety, economic security, better opportunities, and an overall sense that their families would have a better future. Americans are also afraid. Between January and November, 67 U.S. citizens, many of them transgender, have requested asylum in the Netherlands. Last year, there were 9. No applications have been approved this year. In October, a Rutgers professor named Mark Bray moved to Spain after receiving death threats at his home, prompted by a petition from the school's chapter of the conservative group Turning Point USA to have him fired. Bray is a scholar of anti-fascism, so the dynamics of this aren't alien to me, per se, he told me. But you know the Nietzsche quote, if you stare long enough into the void stares back. Everything I'd been writing about was suddenly looking at me through the void. Debbie and Bain's contingency planning was frantic at first, spurred on by extreme zombie apocalypse scenarios, as Debbie remembered it. They envisioned having their passports revoked or being detained for having said the wrong things. Debbie was especially preoccupied with Project 2025, a blueprint for the country conceived by the Heritage Foundation. Trump had distanced himself from the conservative think tank during his campaign, but once in office, he openly pushed to sign its prescriptions into law. When her life went on as usual, albeit against a backdrop of disturbing headlines, she said, it evolved to, why do we have to wait for something extreme to happen? She and Bain could not afford to drop hundreds of thousands of dollars on a Caribbean investor passport. They looked into Canada. Americans assume they're welcome there, but did not qualify for permits based on their work or education. They found no prospects in Spain, Portugal, or the UK either. Then, while browsing Facebook in the spring, Debbie discovered GTFO Tours. The company's founders, Yana Sanchez and Bethany Quinn, posted links and comments that spoke to Debbie's concerns about Trump's America, but they seemed also to have practical advice. In a Zoom call, Sanchez explained that, thanks to the Dutch-American Friendship Treaty, an agreement signed in 1956 to promote bilateral investment, Bain could register his business in the Netherlands, capitalize it with 4,500 euros, and bring Debbie along. They could be gone in a matter of months. Debbie had never given the Netherlands, a country of 18 million people, all that much thought. She had visited Amsterdam in her 20s, and she'd learned in school that the pilgrims had lived there before setting off for the New World. Then she remembered that the artworks in her home with Bain, a pair of paintings from her grandparents, a set of cookie molds hanging on a wall, and prints of paintings by Van Gogh and Vermeer were all Dutch. I love antiquing, and I found this cute little lithograph that I thought was maybe a street in Paris, Debbie told me. A few weeks ago, I got a hunch and put it through Google Lens, and sure enough, it's Amsterdam. Who has all this Dutch artwork? She marveled. It seemed as sure a sign as any. In Harlem, on Sunday, the Americans convened in the lobby of their hotel to meet a real estate agent, or maquilar, named Daniel Pilon, who had emigrated to the Netherlands from South Africa. The number of Americans approaching Pilon this year has increased tenfold. It's the political situation, he told me. But many give up, he said, when they can't find an apartment. It's difficult because they are serious, but not serious enough, he said. The Netherlands cities have a persistent housing shortage. It's not unusual for there to be 40 people at an apartment viewing, Pilon explained, each with higher salaries and better references than the last. Someone asked him what a perfect candidate looked like. The single person coming on a work contract for 2 years working for a big company, he replied without missing a beat. Self-employed workers arriving on the DAFT visa are at a disadvantage. Landlords prefer Dutch work contracts as proof of income, so Americans sometimes offer a year's rent up front. Sanchez pressed Pilon for the monthly cost in euros. How much would you suggest for a budget? She prompted. 2,500, he said. Are you only competing with other expats? Oh, also Dutch people. Most Dutch people will not be paying over 3,000. Dutch people buy, Sanchez added. The interest rates here are like 3%. If you have a Dutch contract, you're loving life. Sanchez lives on the bank of a Harlem canal in a townhouse with her Dutch husband, Edwin. They bought the place in the year 2000. At 61, Sanchez, who has hazel eyes, freckles, and leonine gray hair that she pulls back with a scrunchie, is intensely personable, if prone to hyperbole. She describes her role with GTFO as an escaping fascism doula, and seemed a little hurt when I said I wasn't making plans to leave the States. Nobody thinks their great-grandparents left Germany too early, she and Quinn reminded me on several occasions. On the desk of her home office are two canonical texts of the American Resistance, How Fascism Works by Jason Stanley and On Tyranny by Timothy Snyder. Both authors recently left Yale to work at the University of Toronto. One of GTFO's selling points is, perhaps paradoxically, how very American its approach is. Sanchez has a warm Southern confidence, addressing clients, waitstaff, even strangers on the commuter rail like old pals. She also has a habit of reading alarming news headlines off her phone out loud. That, I suppose, is part of her pitch. Sanchez's Americanness is rivaled only by Quinn's. A 40-year-old from the Washington, D.C. area with theater kid energy, Quinn worked in policy for the Service Employees International Union and has an MBA from Johns Hopkins. She believes that Americans are traumatized by Trump's assaults on both the Constitution and their constitutions. When I come to the Netherlands, I feel my blood pressure drop, she remarked in Harlem, and then I go to the U.S. and it's back up again. In addition to Debbie and Bain, the GTFO group had three participants, a Pennsylvania resident who didn't want to be identified, and a couple in their early 40s named Rita and Chris. They, like Debbie, were military veterans. After our session with the real estate agent in Harlem, we took the train to Utrecht, a university town about 30 miles away. An American musician in his 50s named Jeffrey Scott Pearson served as our guide. He had left the U.S. back in 2017. Not long after his move, he had a heart attack. I was in the hospital for 2-3 weeks, and as an American, I wondered what that would cost me, he said, rolling up his left sleeve to reveal a long, skinny scar from where his surgeon had taken a blood vessel to graft. But when the bill came back, it was 312 euros, and all of it was for parking and the pizza I ordered from the commissary. Even with health insurance in the United States, it would have cost me $35,000. The Americans nodded in sober recognition. They all had conditions to manage, asthma, ADHD, rheumatoid arthritis, various injuries, and found medical care expensive and hard to navigate. According to a Harris poll, 38% of those surveyed cited health care as a reason for considering a move abroad. Rita and Chris have spent their lives chasing stability. They grew up in Colorado in chaotic families and met in high school Spanish class when Rita was a freshman and Chris a senior. They married 4 years later. Their wedding reception was at Denny's. They had a military discount, Rita recalls, and the next day Chris left for field training in preparation for going to Iraq. Chris, who has short blonde hair and an athletic build, had been offered a scholarship to run track at Michigan State, but couldn't afford to go because his family could not complete his financial aid paperwork. He says he joined the military to break the cycle of poverty. He served two tours before he was caught in an explosion and a serious spinal cord injury put him in retirement. Chris's body is still peppered with shrapnel, and even after surgery, the right side of his face is a little dented. Rita couldn't afford a college initially either, so she did odd jobs and entered beauty pageants for extra cash. She served in the Navy as a logistics specialist and enrolled in college as a reservist while Chris convalesced, waiting for his disability payments. She went on to get a master's degree in organizational leadership. In 2021, the pair moved to Iowa, where Rita ran a student veteran center at a local college. She had a bad feeling when the state's Board of Regents began scrapping diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in 2023. But when Trump was elected, again, her instincts told her to run. We'd watch the news, Chris and I, and we'd see something really bad and say, "We gotta get out," Rita recalled. The president reminded them of all the things that had been wrong with the United States for as long as they could remember. They were bamboozled, in Rita's words, about the Iraq War, and now they're using the military against their own people, Chris lamented. Rita channeled her anxiety into cleaning, in preparation for leaving the country. Rita and Chris are not ideological. They like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren's economic positions, but would have been okay with a Republican such as Mitt Romney or the late John McCain in office. They were not planning to leave during Trump's first term either. Trump derangement syndrome, this is not. Rather, Rita and Chris have come to understand their experience as U.S. citizens as a form of moral injury, or the distress a person feels after witnessing an event that transgresses one's deeply held values. Chris already struggled to square his own sense of what was right with the orders he received in Iraq, where the war is estimated to have killed more than 200,000 civilians. As with Debbie and Bain, the couple's unease had to do with everyday ethical concerns. If you have any kind of empathy, it's hard to live in the U.S. and watch what's happening, Chris said. I feel like I'm screaming at the top of my lungs, saying, "The house is on fire," while there are people actively telling me the house is not on fire and they're actively being burned, Rita said. Over lunch in Utrecht, Rita and Chris surprised the group with an announcement. They were buying an apartment in the city of Delft. It seemed a bit rash. They'd been in the Netherlands for only a few weeks, but the couple knew that they would not be returning home. The Netherlands is a natural place for an American to seek refuge. The Dutch influence is everywhere in America, in architecture, barns, stoops, gabled roofs, food, waffles, donuts, tiny pancakes, and oligarchs, from the Vanderbilt dynasty to the Koch brothers. The language sounds like American English until you realize you don't understand a word. Reading Dutch is quite the opposite experience, however. Stare hard enough at its abundance of strange vowels and you'll uncover meaning. Not that it matters. English is spoken widely and well by citizens of all ages, which makes Dutch hard to practice. They respond in English because it's more efficient, Sanchez said. Culturally, the Dutch are sometimes known on the continent as the Americans of Europe, owing to their large stature, loud voices, and blunt manners. This stops being true the moment actual Americans come to town and proceed to outweigh, out-talk, and generally out-everything the locals. Out-apologize, too, for blocking the bike path, mispronouncing a word, ordering the wrong condiment. "My husband gets so embarrassed when I ask for ketchup, horribly embarrassed," Sanchez said over fries at lunch one day. Sanchez is quick to say she's sorry because she knows what the Dutch are thinking. There is a perception that Americans bring with them American problems, like higher costs, fake news, and bad food. As a class, expats are seen as transient, insular, and rich. Some can even benefit from a 30% tax break originating from a 1964 ruling designed to attract skilled foreign workers. Sanchez encourages tour participants to be humble and not make trouble. "We are immigrants, not expats," she said. "You have to think like an immigrant." When migration scholars describe why people move, they generalize motivations into pull factors or reasons to come, and push factors, or reasons to go. For GTFO's clientele, the push is self-evident, but the pull is somewhat less defined. The Netherlands has many good qualities, such as excellent social services, great infrastructure, proximity to European capitals. For this group, though, its primary appeal is the country it is not. It's also hard to overstate the influence of social media on Americans' escape fantasies. One morning, as Sanchez showed us around Harlem, Debbie waved down a man in a beanie who was filming a video on the street. "Are you Sky?" she called out. She turned back to the group. He's a very popular YouTuber. The man was, in fact, Sky, or as he's known online, ITZSKY. There was much talk of anti-fascism and anti-anti-fascism during our tour. Back home, Americans were reeling from the assassination of Charlie Kirk, the founder of Turning Point USA. But lurking in the background on our Dutch tour was the question of whether European nations were themselves delaying an inevitable descent into Trump-style demagoguery. In October, a few weeks after our visit, the Netherlands elected a center-left party, D66, to lead the next government. But the country has also produced Geert Wilders, a proto-Trump figure whose party for freedom came in a close second. Over the past decade, countries around the world have either elected right-wing leaders or come awfully close. If these politics are what Americans are fleeing, is anywhere truly safe? One day, on the train, as Sanchez worried aloud about Trump's plans to persecute his ideological foes, a passenger chimed in, speaking in accentless English, to point out that it was happening in the Netherlands as well. The week before, Wilders had called on Parliament to designate Antifa a terrorist organization. He won a majority. In the Dutch parliamentary process, these motions function as recommendations for government ministers. "But you don't have crazy far-right religious fanatics," Sanchez replied. "Well, that's true," the passenger conceded. The next day, on a trip to The Hague, we encountered a bedraggled-looking group of anti-abortion protesters outside the train station. They were waving signs about Christianity and fetal personhood. It all felt very familiar. Sanchez, irate, scared off an elderly man who tried to hand her a flyer. "No, absolutely not," she snapped. We were walking with our guide, a young architectural history student named Oscar Onk. He ushered us through the field where, three nights before, 1,500 anti-immigration protesters had set fire to a police car and smashed the windows of D66's offices. As we watched workers clean up the debris, Sanchez asked Onk, for the benefit of the group, whether the anti-migrant protests were also about Americans or just asylum seekers. "Your privilege. You'd be exposed to people who keep their opinions to themselves," Onk demurred. The truth is that white-collar, and just white, foreigners are very much a part of the country's immigration culture wars. Rob Jetten, the leader of D66, defended them, telling a Dutch news site, "The idea that expats come in here like some kind of predators and then leave is simply untrue." Ambivalent as some Dutch citizens might be about immigration, the country has a robust infrastructure for welcoming outsiders. The municipality of The Hague, where about half the residents are first or second generation immigrants, operates a gleaming international center. And on Wednesday, a young woman named Sarah Feid hosted our group there for a seminar on relocation, logistics, and integration. Feid explained some local customs, manners. The Dutch are very direct. How to find a good bike. And the polder model. The Dutch approach to making decisions in a spirit of collaboration, consensus, and compromise. "We are a very equal, non-hierarchical society," Feid said. "The cleaning lady, the CEO, the intern, the junior, the senior, everybody's input is valued." The Americans, myself included, seemed a little disbelieving until Feid's intern vigorously agreed. Feid also told us about Tikkie, a popular mobile app that splits checks down to the cent. Going Dutch is, as it turns out, Dutch. On the last full day of the tour, GTFO traveled to Rotterdam, a taller, starker, and more contemporary Dutch city than the ones we had seen. It lacked its neighbor's lopsided appeal, having been almost entirely rebuilt after the Second World War. It was cold and gusty, and none of the participants seemed that charmed. While the group went on a 3-hour walk, more than 22,000 steps, they informed me, I fought a cold brought on by the Netherlands' terrible weather and sought refuge in Phoenix, a museum built inside a converted warehouse dedicated to migration. There I visited a 200-photo exhibit titled The Family of Migrants. The collection was a tribute to The Family of Man, a 1955 Museum of Modern Art show curated by Edward Steichen, which captured people in every stage of life, from birth to the grave. The show was intended as a post-war declaration of global solidarity, but critics panned Steichen for alighting the determining weight of history, of genuine and historically embedded differences, injustices, and conflicts, as Susan Sontag put it. Perhaps because of such schmaltzy sentimentality, the show was a hit, and 10 million people saw it on its world tour. Many of the Americans I had met in the Netherlands had a lot in common with the subjects of the exhibit. They, too, would leave their loved ones behind. They, too, would haul around their belongings, fill out paperwork, and arrive at their destinations a little dazed. They would leave because they felt they had to and because they wanted to. They would leave because they could. GTFO's participants are not refugees in the traditional sense, at least not yet. None were in immediate danger. They could move to Vermont, Massachusetts, or California. They'd all thought about changing states, of course, but had concluded it was not enough. These decisions, I think, say more about the U.S. than they do about the people making them. Nevertheless, The Family of Migrants was a reminder that Americans' growing appetite for expatriation is a historical anomaly. For centuries, tens of millions of impoverished immigrants have settled in the U.S. seeking safety, prosperity, and happiness, transforming the country in indelible, wonderful ways. I came to the U.S. from Switzerland as a student in 2004 and ran the gauntlet of visa and green card application before naturalizing in 2022. But I'm not so sure I'd be welcome now. I'm not even sure I'd move here at all now. Is there anything worth staying for? I ask myself this question a lot during my week immersed in the Dutch way of life. I came back to the same old reasons: family, community, work. Then, for a moment at the museum, a portrait by Xianxi Chang made me remember what I love about New York City, and I suppose an idea about America that's still hard to shake. In the photo, a recent Chinese immigrant is in his underwear, eating a bowl of noodles on a fire escape. He has chopsticks in one hand and holds a bowl up to his mouth with the other. The man's perch overlooks the Bowery, and the cars pass beneath him, oblivious of his presence. He has the best seat in the house. He looks free. Walking around Harlem at dusk, I had noticed that the occupants of the loveliest townhouses along the canals made a point of leaving their blinds open, perhaps to show, in the old Calvinist tradition, that they have nothing to hide. I admired the tidy interiors, the high beamed ceilings, the moldings that reminded me of Brooklyn brownstones. I wandered for hours through winding alleys and waterfront streets, peering into windows. I saw no one eating noodles in his underwear. As usual, I'll end with some poetry. From the December 15, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, Almost Home by Adrian Matechka. We know some things, man, about some things, Bob Kaufman said, strutting down another San Francisco street on his way from there to whatever's here. His pockets were turned out to their linty parts, like a magician's mid-trick. He had a dull pencil tucked between his ear and his preternatural afro. I followed up roller coaster hills past misbegotten alley kisses, hummingbirds everywhere, hitchhike thumbing California's daylight. Bob Kaufman loved San Francisco's gentle malaise. Long views of bay and insistent bridge, the ocean right after. I'm from Indiana, where dirt roads lead to other dirt roads that always lead to fields of blondly tasseled stalks wafted by local infidelities. When the wind kicks up, crops stammer secrets recklessly as the gnats cloud in buggy doubts above those lazy farmers in repose. Just like the poets in San Francisco, Chez lounging it in silk kimonos for their gorgeous sun-slicked photos. Everyone stays skyward out here. Just then, Bob Kaufman turned a corner in his own quick reverie and started up and down the coronary hills of a city everyone talks about, but nobody can afford to love. Not like my hometown of Indianapolis, where four skyscrapers stand affordably in the center of your wallet's imagination. They subsidize everybody's big ideas while the penthouse couple fishes for a third of their kinky party. There's even a cuck chair in their bedroom where the husband watches his wife being ravished. Indy can be just as fantastic and horny as San Francisco or Paris at times. For a time, Bob Kaufman was the most famous poet in France, bigger than Verlaine or the pirate Rimbaud. But in San Francisco, during his 10 years of silence, he was wrong-eyed and woebegone. He stayed silent and alone, as if not naming the words ricocheting in his ears could sustain him while passers-by side-eyed him up and down. His hobo couture, street sleeping, all those paper bag manifestos. We've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.